Good morning. We conclude our months-long exploration of imagination today. And I just look at my calendar today and I think, just imagine. Imagine that this morning we're going to see up on this screen images of art and architecture throughout time and throughout the world. Imagine we're going to hear from a storyteller about the ancient and beautiful stories of the First Nations people of this part of the world. Imagine that tonight I'm going to sing some Duke Ellington to those of you who come out for this evening, because Duke Ellington wrote, believe it or not, sacred music, but that's a story for tonight. Imagination has played an important role in all of human history, imagining what life could be, what life should be, and even what life is at its fullest. Without our imaginations, things are kind of flat and pale and uninteresting. Imagine where we would be without our imaginations. I don't even want to. So Keisha Bramadat is our chalice lighter. She's going to come up and kindle our flame, which will remind us that we all need a spark sometimes. A spark of imagination, a spark of possibility, and sometimes, maybe even most of the time, we need other people to remind us of where that spark comes from. So come, let us remember the beauty of imagination. Come, let us worship together. I'm going to invite any other children, including children in the children's choir, to come on over to the quilts here. If there are any other children in the back, and if you're new, feel free to bring your grown-up with you if you'd like to, because they can then take you out to your classes. Good. I see that we're getting more buddies up here. And I'm going to let JB introduce himself, because he did a beautiful job of speaking with me this morning about the meaning and significance of his name, because I think names are important. We all were given names when we were born, and so JB is going to share the story with you, and here he is.
I put you. How you say good morning in my language, in Sinchasan language. My name is John Bradley Williams. Can you guys all hear me okay? Okay. My name is John Bradley Williams. I'm Kusanich in a house. Kusanich is a proper way to pronounce the First Nations people that live out on the Saanich Peninsula here. Our traditional territory is all of the Saanich Peninsula, the Gulf Islands, the San Juan Islands. It extends over to the mainland to Tsawwassen. And Tsawwassen is the proper way to pronounce their village site. And it extends down south, down to Lummi First Nations, down in Washington State there. Our traditional territory also extends as far north as the Cowichan Lakes, so we have quite a substantial territory as Saanich people. And as for Housit, we're just a little island off of Tofino, about halfway up Vancouver Island. So through my heritage, I have two-thirds of Vancouver Island covered. And what I mean by that is there's three major language families on Vancouver Island. There's the Salish language, Nutonish language, and forgive me, but I'm still trying to learn how to pronounce the Kwagawal language family. Within all three of our language families, we have sub-dialects to them. Within our Salish language, we have 36 known dialects. Within the Nutonish, we have 16 known dialects. And within the Kwagawal, there's 6 dialects that they have, but today they primarily only use 2. Shall I share that my name that I was?
Sure, or your story.
Well, I'll share my name story later when we go to the farmhouse. There's a few different stories that came into mind when I was first approached by Faye to come and do storytelling with you guys. The first one that came to mind is the Saanich flood story. Then the second one that came to mind is my favorite story, which is their creation of the killer whale. But given the time parameters, I decided that I would go with my daughter's favorite story. So my daughter's favorite story is actually the bird song story. It tells about how the four major bird families got their songs in the Saanich territory. And the four major bird families in the Saanich territory a long time ago was the seagull, the crow, the eagle, and the robin. And long ago they all spoke or sung the same song. And this caused problems between the four families because they never knew who was talking to who. Eagle didn't know if it was her little ones trying to talk with her or if it was just the community members talking with each other. So the four elders of those families got together and they called to Raven, because Raven's our communicator between us and hills. He's the one that can travel back and forth from the physical and the spiritual world. So those four elders asked him if he can take a message to Hills and ask him how he can help those four families. And that was the message. How can he help those four families? And Raven agreed to take their message to him. So he hops up and he flies away and leaves the physical world and flies into the spiritual world and meets up with Hills. And he asks him how he can help these four families. And he says to Raven, "Will you go back? And you let them know, I'm not really sure how I can help them at the moment. I'm going to have to sit down and think about this." And Raven, being the smart creature he is, he says, "Well, why don't we have a flying contest then? Whoever flies the highest will get the nicest song." And he says to Raven, "Okay, you go back, you get the four elders, and you tell them this is what needs to be done." So Raven comes back to the physical world, gathers up those four elders, and he tells them, "Whoever flies the highest will get the nicest song." First one up was Seagull. And Seagull got about 20 feet up into the air and started playing in the wind and flying back and forth. Seagull is not the fastest of birds, and I don't mean fastest in flying. He's not the smartest of birds. He completely forgot he was taking part in this contest. And if you listen to him sing, especially when he's playing in the wind, it sounds like he's laughing really, really slow. Second one up was Crow. And Crow says, "I don't need to do this. I'm Raven's brother. I'll get a nice song no matter what." Crow was so arrogant, he thought no matter what he did, he would get a nice song. That's why he sounds so throaty. He never even left the ground. So third one up was Eagle. She flew up and up and up. She rode a hot patch of air and circled and circled and circled. She flew so high that when she did her arc to come back down to earth, her head and her tail touched the clouds and were marked white. But just as she did her arc to come back down to earth, Robin popped up from beneath a feather where he's hiding on. And he flew even higher than Eagle. And when he did his arc to come back down to earth, he flipped upside down. And he flew so high and got so close to the sun, he burnt his chest red. And because he wasn't used to flying so high, he actually started falling back down to earth. Him and Eagle landed at the same time. And Eagle says to Raven, "Look, I made it the highest. My head and my tail are marked white from the clouds." And Robin's bent over on one knee, huffing, puffing away. No, wait, I flew the highest. Look, I got so close to the sun, I burnt my chest red." And Raven's like, "Yes, you did fly the highest, but you cheated to get there. So you can only sing your song early in the morning or early in the evening. Throughout the rest of the day, though, you are only allowed to sing, "I cheated, I cheated, I cheated." He was forced to tell the truth. And because Eagle, she didn't cheat to get to her height, she can choose how she sings her song. She can have those long, drawn-out screeches we know she has, those medium ones, or those really fast clips. So as a reward to Eagle, she can choose how she sings her song. And that's our bird song story. These four birds, they have really important lessons that us humans need to learn on a continuous basis, no matter how young or how old we are. We still need to learn these lessons. In this story, Seagull teaches us to stay focused, especially when we're working towards something. In this story, Crow teaches us that we need to work on our own reputation, our own stature in life. We can't rely on the reputation and stature of our relatives. In this story, Eagle teaches us to work hard, but to do it in a smart manner. So as we're working, we don't grind ourselves down and become tired and useless. In this story, Robin actually has two lessons, one joke one and then one for real one. The joke lesson that Robin teaches us in this story is not to cheat. If we do, don't get caught. And then the for real lesson that Robin teaches us in this story is not to cheat, because if we cheat, we're only cheating ourselves. And my daughter, she's renamed the Robin to the "I Cheated" bird.
Will you join me now in that place of deep reflection, that place of inward gaze, that place of profound meaning that some call meditation and some call prayer? Please join me in that place of reflection now. Spirit of life and of love, as we gather this morning, looking especially at the role of imagination and art in our lives, we bring to mind, each of us, a moment, an experience in which art opened something in us. Maybe it was a day in a gallery when we were feeling bereft when we entered and a painting just took our breath away. Perhaps it was a moment of profound joy when we were so glad and then we walked into a concert and the music made us even more grateful. Perhaps it was a moment when we found ourselves on a dance floor, when we had forgotten until that day that our bodies could be a source of expression, and we just let loose. Whatever and whenever that moment happened, whenever and wherever those moments keep happening for as long as we live, may we be open to those art openings. May we allow them to take us to new and different places. May we be open to the emotion and to the possibilities that they stir within us. And may they help us imagine a world in which all people have new possibilities and possibilities to live out all that they imagine. So for all of this, and for whatever is on our hearts this morning, even those things perhaps for which we have no words, we lift ourselves, our lives, our beings, and our hearts in meditation and in prayer. So may it be. And amen.
Art has always been a big part of my life, either creating it, viewing it, listening to it, or reading it. I studied at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design, and I have a Bachelor of Fine Art. Oil painting was my medium, and I would lose myself for hours in the act of moving all that luscious color around on the canvas. Myself and a couple of others at the college called our style of painting expressive realism. We believed that what we were creating was a broader expression of what was real, in that it didn't hide the artist's hand or our individual experiences. We saw ourselves on the cutting edge of the art world, with our return to using the visual world as our subject matter, but continuing to include the deeper questioning introduced by the conceptual art movement that preceded us. Art for art's sake. The medium is the message. My paintings were invitations for others to see the world through my experience of painting them. But the doing meant more to me than the final results. And with the high cost of materials, I gravitated towards using the cheaper and more universal medium of the written word as my means of self-expression. During this last week, however, while looking online for images for Reverend Shauna, I felt drawn again to my old love. The conceptual stretching and pure delight of seeing where others have allowed their imagination to take them, pondering what red means. It brought me back to my college days when there were no limits to what one could imagine or do. And the world was literally a giant canvas of possibilities. I certainly learned a lot back then about seeing outside of the box and through other people's eyes. And though I'm no longer on the cutting edge of the art world, I hope I brought those two attributes forward into my present life. Whether your tastes lean towards the visual arts, music, or the written word, where have you allowed the art of imagination to take you? And where might you go with it if you gave it free rein?
Thank you for that, choir. That was stirring. And the song they were singing was from the musical Sundays in the Park with George by Stephen Sondheim. And the song they were singing was about this painting, known, I'm sure, to many of you, The Grand Jatte by Georges Seurat. I'm just going to leave that there for a while I begin our exploration of the art of imagination with a few quotations rather than a reading. I found some quotations about imagination that captured me this week. Two of them were from Albert Einstein, of all people. The first from Einstein is, I am enough of an artist to draw freely upon my imagination. Imagination is more important than knowledge. Knowledge is limited. Imagination encircles the world. The second thing that Einstein wrote that captured me was, logic will get you from A to Z. Imagination will get you everywhere. And finally, these words from Mark Twain. You can't depend on your eyes when your imagination is out of focus. Art of imagination. Art has long served as a source of profound meaning and sustenance for me. When push has come to shove in my life, other than family and friends, what gives me hope and lifts me up is art. This is true of art in all of its forms, music, literature, dance. But this morning, I am focusing particularly on visual art and a bit at the end on architecture. Art has helped me in the past imagine a way forward when I couldn't see one for myself. It has helped me to see beauty again when the world had seemed monochrome. It had helped me figure out how to relate to others and to imagine again how I might understand the world in new ways. My parents didn't agree on much in their short-lived marriage, but I would say that the importance of art was one of the two fundamental values that they gave me. As soon as I could walk, I was taken to museums. Every city or place that I visited with them or with one or of the other of them, museums and galleries were the first places we sought out. I have in my bones a deep nostalgia for and feel even, you could say, uncommonly at home in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, because I visited it with my father every single time I was with him. I have thought over the years about why it is that art occupies such a central place for me. Yes, much of it is beautiful. Some of it is provocative. I remember being a child and being scared of a particularly odd Rauschenberg image that included a goat in the middle of it. It speaks to me of history and of possibility, and it also helps me understand the world. Imagine that. So I thought this morning, rather than try to simply describe to you what art means to me or how it impacts imagination, I thought it best to show it to you. So on the screen, with Dar's help this week, I will take you through 5 examples of how artists and architects have inspired imagination in not only me, but I would surmise millions of others. And we begin with Seurat. A Sunday on Le Grand Jatte was painted in 1884. It is 81 by 121 inches. So for those of you, since I'm in Canada now, I realize I need to use the metric system. That means it is 207 by 308 centimeters. It is a large, large painting. It lives in Chicago, and when I entered the room in which it lives, I was blown away. I had always thought, oh, it's kind of nice. Oh, it's kind of neat that he used a bunch of dots to do it. But if you ever have the chance to be in the same room as this painting, and you walk up to it and walk away from it and walk up to it again and walk away from it again, it kind of takes your breath away. How much effort he put into every single dot on that canvas. And as I was reading about the painting this week, I remembered again that there's actually what's not in this image is a whole border that he added on 5 years later in 1889. He added an entire border to the painting, which is all just dots. Pointillism is amazing in its precision, and yet there's something about it that just flows, that just feels like it's not at all a series of dots, but just one coherent, beautiful image. Seurat's version of a view of modern life at that time in Paris. I look at it, and every time I think I could just walk right on and start up a conversation with any of those people. Imagine the effort to create, the thought that went into it, and what it might have been like to have been there in 1884 on Le Grand Jatte, talking with any of those people, chasing the dog or the monkey. And I love that the song the choir just sang for us talked about walking through the trees. The next painter that we're going to explore is completely different. Now for something completely different, I feel like I should say. Welcome to the world of Barnett Newman. Barnett Newman is someone that my mother, I always listen to my mother, and she told me when I was visiting her in Philadelphia once that I needed to go see a huge retrospective of Barnett Newman's work at the Philadelphia Museum of Art across the street from her condo. And I said, Barnett Newman, that's boring. It's just a bunch of solid colors and a few little lines. Anybody could paint that, I said. Why would I go see that? She said, stay with me. Go see it and get the audio tour. I said, okay. So let's see the next image. So then I didn't realize that Barnett Newman's works, much like the last one we just saw, are huge. Some of them, not all of them. But this image is a painting that's called Who's Afraid of Red? Right? And Barnett Newman was a part of this entire school of painters called the Abstract Expressionists. And what really captured me was that part of the point of this style of painting wasn't to represent anything, but was how it made you feel. Barnett Newman and all the Abstract Expressionists were painting after World War II, and they thought, what could we possibly paint that could mean anything now? Given all that the world has been through, we can't paint a bowl of fruit. We can't paint just a portrait of a person. What's that going to mean to anyone right now? So instead, Barnett Newman and others were talking, you know, he's color field like Mark Rothko, he's the same time period as Jackson Pollock with his crazy drippy paintings. Barnett Newman said, I want people to come into a room with a painting like this and experience red. What does red do to you? And then he painted these weird little lines, you know, in this painting you see that one white line, and then there's one line that's a little slightly different. And I read a lot of different things about what they mean. He called them zips, Z-I-P, it's a zip. I read lots of different explanations, but I actually think my favorite explanation of the zip was on that audio tour, which was that you can see the zip as a place for you to enter the painting. Barnett Newman said that his work was mystical abstraction, that he saw himself as doing something that tried to have a unifying factor to it, a totality to it. So imagine meaning after disaster, meaning after war, meaning after genocide. Maybe it's a lot of red. Now for something completely different, we go all the way back, and I mean all the way back, to the 15th century. To a man by the name of Giovanni Bellini, to perhaps one of my most profound experiences with art. I was just back in Washington, D.C., and I was sitting around a table with many of the congregants who knew me best from my time there, and they talked about my talking about this painting a decade ago. That's how big this has been to me, this particular encounter with this painting. This Giovanni Bellini painting is an altarpiece in a church in Venice called San Zechariah. Giovanni Bellini lived from 1430 to 1516. And this, he was part of a huge Italian Renaissance family of painters. His father was a painter, his brother was a painter. And he was known for sort of revolutionizing Venetian painting at that time to make it more sensuous and more coloristic. There's one more image we have of this, and Dar's going to show it to you now. It's hard for me to try to explain to you just how remarkable this painting is, but we walked into this small church, and this is on a side aisle, kind of toward the back of the building. And when we walked in, there was no light on this at all. So we just walked right past it and went up to the front altar, which has this amazing painting by Titian of Mary's being assumed into heaven, right, that everybody knows about. And I kept thinking, can you imagine if this was your local parish and you just came and worshiped with Titian every Sunday? But we walked back out of the church and we noticed a little box sitting there that said something like a luminare on it. And we figured out our Italian's not good, but it was good enough to realize that if we put money in, a light would go on. So there aren't indulgences now, but there is light for painting. And so we put a coin in the box, and the light turned on this painting. And it was amazing. It's the holy conversation. It's Mary and some saints, and, you know, okay, they're cool. But I felt like the fabric looked like you could just touch it. It almost looked like you could eat it, if you could possibly eat a fabric. There was a sensuousness to this painting that here it had sat for hundreds and hundreds of years, and yet it could captivate me. It could pull me in to this conversation, this eternal conversation. This altarpiece, if you ever go to Venice again, I highly recommend putting the coin in the box and spending a little bit of time with this altarpiece, which he painted in 1505. You may, like I did, feel engulfed in this holy conversation between Mary and the saints. Imagine believing in the Christian story so deeply that your painting could still tell of it hundreds of years after your death. Imagine inviting others in to that conversation through color and fabric. Now, for something completely different. At the end of March, you could say that I was unreasonably saddened by the death of Dame Zaha Hadid, the Iraqi British architect who died at the age of 65 in a Miami hospital after a heart attack. She was the first female and the first Muslim ever to win the Pritzker Prize, which is kind of the holy grail of architecture awards. It honors a living architect whose built work demonstrates a combination of those qualities of talent, vision, and commitment, which has produced consistent and significant contributions to humanity. This is the Heydar Aliyev Center in Baku, Azerbaijan. This building exists in the world. Zaha Hadid was known as the Queen of the Curve. Can you see why? We have several images of this building. I'm going to let Dar show you another. And then when you look at it from the outside like this, you start to wonder, well, what's it like inside this thing? So we'll show you another. And you think, looking at these images of this building, what an amazing How could you not think of that as a work of art? I read all of these descriptions of her work, and it said in one of them that they found her work highly expressive, sweeping fluid forms of multiple perspective points and fragmented geometry that evoke the chaos and flux of modern life. Let's see the last one. There's a concert hall inside. I was so sad when I heard that she died because I want more of this. Talk about an imagination to think that buildings can curve like that and that they should or could, to think that a building can reflect the chaos and flux of modern life, that a building could look almost like mercury or some sort of something that's not solid while being solid at the same time. Talk about imagination. What does it mean to inhabit a space? And how can the space affect you or move you? Imagine buildings that reflect life, that inspire the senses, that invite feeling. Our last move is not to something completely different. I think we have one more image of this, and then we go to the last building. Lastly, we look at the Milwaukee Art Museum, and a building created, designed by Spaniard Santiago Calatrava. I just love saying his name, Santiago Calatrava. He made this building, this Milwaukee Art Museum, to look like a bird taking flight. It does it not? A bird taking flight, perched and ready to head out over Lake Michigan because it's right on the edge of one of the Great Lakes. We have a few images of the bird. From another angle, wings. And one more angle, from behind. They just built a whole other addition to this art museum, so even though Milwaukee is not at the top of my list of destinations, it might need to move up a little bit. Because I would like to be near the bird. And after JB's story this morning about bird song, imagine making a building that looks like it's in motion. Imagine creating something that invites you to think about taking off. Imagine a building that reminds you that that's exactly what art does often. It helps us start in one place and move somewhere else to think about going up and out beyond the horizons of what we have seen before or known could exist. When I was looking at all these images, thinking of all of these things, I was thinking about this magical thing that happens, about how art takes us places we likely could not go on our own, that the imagination of the artist invites us to look again at our lives and our world and to think differently. Magic seems to occur when our imagination and the artist's meet. And rarely, and I do mean rarely, are we unchanged after that interaction. For my money, it has always been worth the price of admission to go to any of these places that have unlocked my heart, opened my spirit, asked me to think again about what is meaningful and valuable and important in being alive. Art has always taken me on a journey. T.S. Eliot wrote famously, "We shall not cease from exploration And the end of all of our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Imagine a building that flies, a curved space of chaos, an altarpiece in a small parish church in Venice, a zip canvas after World War II, a dotted scene of suburban Paris life in the 19th century. Imagine life in all places and times. Imagine your life now and here. How does art intersect with you? And where might it take you next? Imagine. The world of art is a miraculous one. About my neck, I wear a stole that has a little bit of Kandinsky in it. Modeled after a painting of his entitled Mood Line, my stole tells the story of my ministry and my life as it was given to me by those who know of my love for art. Whatever art it is that speaks to you, whether image or song or word, may it help you, like that Calatrava building, to spread your wings and head to new horizons. So may it be now and always.